The following talk was given by Steve Hagen at Dharma Field Meditation and Learning Center in Minneapolis on February 27, 2022. This talk may not be played or reproduced for profit.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good to see you all. There's a Zen story, I think. Seems like I read this somewhere a long time ago, maybe. I don't know where it's from, but it goes something like, the details really don't matter. The point that I want to use in my talk here will come through, even if I botch up the story a bit. But it's a story about a Zen priest who was asked to, I believe it was something like perform a wedding. So he traveled there to perform the wedding, and when he got there, the people were disappointed with the robe he was wearing because they knew he had a much fancier robe. And so they sent him back to get his robe. So when he went back and he dug out his robe there, the one that they wanted to see, and he gave it to his assistant and told him to bring the robe to the wedding. There's probably more to the story than that. This is the assistant arrives with just the robe. But it says something about us, I think, where we can easily lose the essentials. What do you really want this priest to bring? Was it just simply his robe? Well, there's a passage here in Wang Po. I'm just going to read this. I was going to try to recite it, but I'm getting old and I don't remember exactly the punchy language here. It'd be better than anything I could try to conjure up. So let me just read this. Here Wang Po says, there's only the one mind and not a particle of anything else on which to lay hold. If you students of the way do not awaken to this mind, you will overlay mind with conceptual thought. You will seek Buddha outside yourselves, reality, truth. You will seek Buddha outside yourselves, and you will remain attached to forms, pious practices, and so on, all of which are harmful. Harmful, he says, and not at all the way to supreme knowledge. So all these things are harmful. Harmful in what way? Well, they're harmful in that they keep us distracted. They keep us from seeing really what's important here, at least in terms of living out of awakeness, being awake. It's easy for us to get into all sorts of things. The people who wanted the priest to wear the fancy robe to the wedding, wasn't it just for him to oversee the ceremony? No, they wanted the robe. He's kind of losing sight of what's important here. And this is what Wang Po is getting at here, where he says, if you don't wake up to reality, really is what he's saying here, you will overlay mind, reality, truth, is mind with a capital M here. You will overlay mind, he says, with conceptual thoughts, ideas, beliefs, stories, and you will seek reality, Buddha, he says here, but this is reality, truth, outside yourselves, outside of what is yourself. It's not something particular like you might think. You know, it's just confined to your body here, and I've taken you through this so many times, I don't think I need to do it again. But you're never going to pin it down, just what that is. You know, so he says, you will seek outside, you'll see yourself here separate and apart from everything else, and then you go seeking out there, looking for what? Something you're making up in your mind? Do you know? And can you say? The moment you say anything at all, this is truth, this is reality, this is mine. Buddha, this is enlightenment. Whatever you say, this is the very definition of delusion. You can't say, you can't put your finger on it, you can't grasp it, you can't get hold of it, truth, reality. But this is where we go, all the time, every time. And we do it so quickly. And we miss just what is taking place here. He says, you will seek out. So you're, first of all, just seeking. You don't need to seek for anything. What do you think you are? This is reality right here. Thus, you're never apart from it. There's no such thing as being apart from it. And you can look at that in various ways. That word part and apart or particle. You know, we'll see things as separate and distinct from other things. And apart from me here, if you see yourself as something here and separate. And of course this is, unless we wake up, this is how we see everything. And so we remain caught in just this way. He says, you'll seek outside yourselves and you will remain attached to forms. Forms, things, not just physical forms necessarily, but also thoughts and ideas, concepts, beliefs. We remain attached to these things. Completely swallowed up and churning about with these things. Totally, completely oblivious to what it is that Wang Po's trying to help us notice here. But this is all we are. This is the situation we always find ourselves in. And so we'll remain attached to forms. Pious practices. Yeah, pious practices of various kinds. We can even turn our practice of meditation, zazen, into a pious practice of some sort. I remember once hearing a fellow it was a workshop that was taking place here actually, and we had a guest who was leading it, and somehow some discussion going on, or people were bringing up things around the room, and someone then identified that their practice was Shikan Taza. Of course, that's the apex of meditation practice, Shikan Taza. Yeah, well, fine, but you can't do that. I can't do it. You're not going to get a hold of it. You're not going to get one particle of anything here. A person. Shikan Taza itself. That someone then can take on. This is my practice. And this is what all the time, is it? If this is Shikan Taza, where are you? What do you mean? You do Shikan Taza. You are something apart, separate. You know, you're taking on this other. You're very confused there. Of course, we talk about Shikan Taza. We point it out. This is our practice, we might say. But who's doing it? Who does that? Who can do that? You mean human beings can't do Shikan? If Shikan Taza is being carried out as a practice, who's doing it? Yeah. So there's no Shikan Taza? No, there's Shikan Taza. Are there people who practice? Yes, we can say that. But you can't get hold of any one thing here. Longpo speaks in that way. There's not one part. I think it was just up ahead here. He says, you can't get hold of one particle of anything at all. But still we see everything in this way. We don't see things as just thus. And this is what he's speaking of here when he says, you will overlay mine and you will seek Buddha outside yourselves. You'll seek for things, you know, you'll seek for reality outside, in those things out there that have been particularized and divided and separated in all kinds of ways. Not just physical things, but thoughts, feelings, things where we draw the distinctions and draw the lines in our minds. And then we think these things can do things, and I want to do, you know, shikantaza, whatever. I identify with that. I'm one who does shikantaza. But this is all very confused. This might seem like a very ordinary mind, and it is. But this is without any understanding of awakening itself. It's just our ordinary mind. And we get attached to these things and attached to forms then and pious practices that are separate and distinct from other kinds of practices. Maybe the ones that I identify with are better than yours, you know. Or maybe you're very sloppy in your life and you don't even think of yourself as practicing anything, even though, of course, you do. Well, how could we not? And then, what, I should compare mine to yours? Do you compare yours to mine? Your practice is so much better and all that? Well, it's just ordinary human world. Pretty soon we can start to fight. The world's all broken up. And we think some of these pieces are better than others. I want those, and I want to take those on. I want to practice those. I want to identify with that. I do this. This is my practice. You don't have to live this way, you know. If you just look at it for a while, stay with it and just look at it, you can see how delusional it is, how silly, how confused. In the meantime, this is life right here unfolding. Thus, Buddha, ultimate reality, ultimate truth. Right here, going on in spite of what you might be thinking or doing or occupying yourself with. And at any moment, you can wake up to it. But consider what that would mean. How can you wake up to it when you're totally engaged in one thing or another, and there's literally, I suppose, millions or quadrillions of things we could be occupied with. It's endless. And then we'll and maybe encounter a practice like this and a teaching like this, and then we'll take it up in some particular way. I don't know what, thinking we're getting something from it. And that we need this, we need to do this. When we're living out reality, I mean, it's not that we are living it out, reality is being lived out. Pay attention. Don't say anything. The moment you say something, well, sometimes you need to talk with others or even maybe remind yourself of something. Sure. But the moment you think, aha, this is it, just realize that whatever it is, it's just some imagined thing in your mind. I say your mind, but of course that's an imagined thing as well. Anyway, it gets parsed out, and you're looking at this, grasping this. This is just an imagined existence. There's no way you can manipulate that or work with that, plow your way through that. That brings enlightenment. Enlightenment isn't anywhere else. You don't need to seek it. But if you carry on as though it were just one other commodity, one other thing in your life that you want to acquire. You'll never find it, but you also block yourself from seeing just this, realizing just this, that you've been engaged in endlessly, beginninglessly. So he says, if you don't awaken to just this, he's saying, mind. Yeah, you'll remain attached to forms and pious practices and so on, he says, and all the other things. And the robes, you know, the time that we've been here, when I was head teacher, you know, we didn't have a lot of that. I hope I'm sharing a little bit of a sense of why I didn't want us to engage in things like that to any large degree. Because you'll be taken by it. You'll do it for the certificate. You'll do it for the recognition or the whatever. But of course, anybody who recognizes that and or gets angry with you or thinks you're stupid. This is what foolish people do. And it involves just about all of us, really. We're being fooled by the superficial stuff that comes and goes. And we allow ourselves to be taken by that. You know, so easily. He says, you seek for Buddha outside yourselves, you will remain attached to forms, pious practices, and so on, and all of which are harmful. All of this stuff is harmful. Harmful in what way? Well, it's harmful in the sense that as long as you remain caught in these ways and seeking, desperately seeking, or just throwing it away and going off to the bar or going off to Tahiti or whatever it is, you know, losing yourself in your profession, your job, whatever. There's endless ways to just tune it all out. Remain fully engaged in whatever the particular thing is that you're engaged with. Or stuff, I should say. You know, but this is what we'll do. And we should be careful. What this practice is, particularly for one who might want to be ordained, there's lay ordination. We remain in lay life pretty much as you were. But you seriously take up this practice and carry it out pretty regularly. You want to give yourself to that. Yeah. And priest ordination is where this comes first. This is what you are. This is what you practice. Not something particular. Don't try to name it, pin it down. Oh, it's Shikantaza, something like that, you know. Zazen, we could say, or Sanzen, I do it right. None of that. Just living day by day with this effort to be here, to be present. Yeah, so it says, so, but this is harmful. And then to the extent that we allow ourselves to be engaged, not even really having a clue as to what we're doing. Let alone to think we have to continue doing this sort of thing to find enlightenment or something like that. It's harmful being engaged in that way. It doesn't mean that you have to stop. You can't stop. You have to take care of your life. You have to go to work. You have to, you know, do all those things. But you don't have to be fooled. And this is the point here. So all of these things, he said, all of these things are harmful and not at all the way to supreme knowledge. In other words, you can't bring yourself to enlightenment through involving yourself in any of these practices or ways or getting the right to certificates or the permission to wear the robes or whatever it might be. It doesn't mean that you shouldn't do any of these things necessarily. But to the extent that we're caught up in such things, thinking that we're getting something from this, or might win over the respect of others or something. And by the way, you know, sometimes people, yeah, they might want to wear these robes. I'm not wearing the full robes now. I rarely do. Listen, conducting a ceremony of some sort. But to wear these robes, and you might think in your mind that, oh, people will respect me then if I wear these robes. Yeah. Well, yeah, maybe some will, but are you deserving of it just because you're wearing some particular, we all wear clothes of some kind, you know, usually. Anything special about that? Of course, we do things like that. We wear the high fashion, the stuff that we dress to impress and that kind of stuff. But yeah, we have to wear something. And we do. But how much do you want to, let that rule your life? And if you see someone wearing these things, you know, or vice versa, it has nothing to do with you. Watch your mind. You can speculate on their mind, but you don't know their mind. I could tell you a little story there, but I guess I won't. That was a personal thing. I'll just say this much. About somebody who was observing me doing something and speculating on where my mind was. It ended up getting printed in a book. This is how I found out about it. They didn't identify me in the book, so I don't try to look for it. And I'm not going to tell you the story or the circumstance exactly. But they got it almost 180 degrees from where I was at the time. Later, I talked to the person about this, and he admitted he was getting a little out of hand with that. And he was angry about something. The thing was much larger than me. But from my part in the story that he was telling, I identified my character. But what I had in mind was quite different, even similar to what he himself was thinking. I just happened to be wearing robes at the time. Well, what I'm trying to say here is that if you see that, don't speculate on where somebody else is and why and how and what's going on in their heart and in their mind. Just be present. Stay right here with what you know. And what you know is not what you think. Whatever you think might be functional and useful, could be hurtful, could be any number of things there. So be careful with that. Watch that. But it isn't what you know. What you do know, unless we wake up, we're just not paying attention to it. And what we know is reality directly. The moment you say something, you're lost. You have to learn that. Recognize that this isn't it. You don't need to do that. Don't do that. It's harmful in terms of wanting to attend to reality or waking up. Yeah. So, and I was going to have this quote here by Suzuki, where he says that right at the beginning of his book, Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind, he says it's difficult for people to practice Zen, he says. But there's a misunderstanding as to why, as he puts it. He says people think it's hard because it's hard to sit in the cross-legged posture. It's hard to attain enlightenment. You know, this is what people think. That's not what makes Zen practice hard or difficult. Because these things really don't matter. And Fukan Zazengi Dogen says, it has nothing to do with sitting or lying down. This matter of enlightenment, you're already there. What's so hard about that? Is it hard to just stop? Maybe it is. Because if you just stop, that's awakening. It won't be you. But it is this direct realization of what's actually going on. And it isn't what we think. And all the stuff that's going on in the world today. War breaking out now. Well, just, could this develop into World War III? What's going to happen there? And the environment. I just came upon a chilling... What was it? It was a program on Nova, I think it was, about some latest developments in global warming and what they're discovering now. And it struck me is that we've already crossed a threshold here. You know, there are these thresholds, we don't know exactly where they are, but it's kind of like you cross this point, we're not going to get back. And it struck me, they didn't say this, but based on what I do know about this stuff, it seems to me that we could very well have crossed the threshold already. So it is a very chilling kinds of things. But don't get caught by your thinking. And don't think that you know. You can have these thoughts, you know, conceptual awarenesses and things like that, and that's fine. It might be helpful in many ways. But don't confuse that with truth. A reality. If you can see this, if you can awaken to this, and keep yourself there, no matter what is going on in the busy world around you, that you might have to attend to, but you don't need to be caught up in that. This kind of reflects, was it Sawaki Roshi, I think, who said that even if an atom bomb goes off over your head, your true nature will not be destroyed. Of course, your true nature is not something you call you. It's just simply thus. But if we were to see that, not hold it as an idea, a theory, a concept, but just see that this is actually how the world is unfolding. Directly, you can see that. If you're not caught up with all this other stuff that we endlessly keep ourselves busy with. Well, then you'll be fine. So what Suzuki Roshi there said, so it's not so hard to attain enlightenment, because it's right here. Just fall back into it. Here it is. Step aside from that busyness of your mind. So this isn't difficult. Or sitting in a crowd. He said what's difficult is to purify your mind, which is just what the Buddha points out about the awakened in the Dhammapada, 183rd verse, which I quote all the time. Do what is wholesome, avoid what is unwholesome. Purify your own mind, which is your own mind is to purify your own mind is thus. It's mind. It's not your mind. And then the Buddha said there, this is the teaching of the awakened. There they have it right there. And this is what Suzuki Roshi is saying too. And don't get caught up like it's difficult to sit in a cross-legged position. It's difficult to attain enlightenment. If you keep going at it like the way we normally go after everything else, it's a commodity, a thing, a particularized thing that you want and to acquire. Yeah. It'd be impossible. This is why people don't seem to wake up. But that's not really the issue. But this isn't difficult. It's just a matter of you stop doing all those things. Awakeness is just right here. It just simply does. But that's what Suzuki Roshi points out. And then just recently, I guess it was in the class I just taught. What was it now? Where are you? The six perfections, yes. Yeah, and the perfection of wisdom, particularly which brings the perfections to the other. Well, never mind. But there we spoke of. We looked at this term, an unsupported thought. This is also bodhicitta, or the thought of enlightenment. And you must, you know, if you have this thought of enlightenment, the bodhisattva, one who's, what can I say, mythical kind of speech here, but destined to awaken. But isn't that, we're on this path to awakening, but that's not the way to look at it, really. But this is the bodhisattva, withholding enlightenment for myself now until all beings are awake, you know, that sort of thing. But don't take any of that too literally. But there we speak of this thought of enlightenment. And we might think then, because we grasp things and take hold of things and we're always casting things in terms of me and what's in it for me and that sort of thing. We're told how important this is, how vital, how imperative that we have this thought of enlightenment. And with this, we have awakening. And we might think, well, I have this thought. That's why I'm taking up this practice, as a matter of fact. I'm seeking for enlightenment. Maybe if I sit enough, so I was in. And very ordinary kind of thinking. You have to understand that ordinary kind of thinking isn't going to help you at all in this matter of waking up. You just simply and to hang on to it and to build things with it and structures and build forms and put on robes and all the stuff that starts to come with it. It just keeps us wallowing in ordinary mind, ordinary thought. When in an instant there's awakening. It's with you now. In each instant, it's just a matter of toning in, waking up. But this thought of enlightenment then, as we looked at it in that class, the six perfections, is called an unsupported thought. Unsupported thought. I remember when I first came upon that term, I thought, what the heck is an unsupported thought? What do you mean? Unsupported thought. I think if I try to think back now to where my mind might have been there, I think I was also even kind of seeing it upside down. Well, wouldn't thought support rather than something as supporting thought? Well, this unsupported thought, well, what exactly is that? And when Suzuki Roshi says, you know, purify your mind, or, well, he didn't know, Buddha said that, but he said, it's difficult to keep your practice pure and your mind pure. In its fundamental sense, I think he puts it. Well, how is that? Well, this purity of mind, you know, that we can live out of, it is with this unsupported thought. In other words, we take the idea of enlightenment. Now, I want enlightenment. I'll get to the maximum meditation you can do, the ultimate, shikantaza, and that will be mine. And I will strive for this. Maybe not everybody takes on that kind of a view, but yeah, I'll. But whatever you're doing there, and particularly in regards to, well, with anything, but really, but in regards to this practice, say, it's just riddled with supported thoughts. Supported by this idea and this notion and this expectation and endless. Look at that. It's in your own mind. Your mind won't be like my mind in that regard. I wouldn't talk to other people about it. You should give them some of your lunatic ideas or something. Just look at your mind. And all the kind of thinking that we do, in regards to anything, really, but certainly when it comes to this matter of waking up. Supported by this notion, that notion, this belief, and I must do that, and practice this, and get this certificate, and wear these robes, and or just get away from all this stuff, and launch yourself into some other career or whatever. And our thinking is constantly supported by what? Reality? Oh, no. It's supported by made-up stuff. Stuff that was just pulled together and think it is this and think it is that. And we use this to justify whatever it is that we're hanging on to. And of course, whatever it is we're hanging on to, that itself, just by the very fact that you're hanging on to it, there's a supported thought. So this enlightenment thing, this is synonymous with this unsupported thought. You can practice this way as well. Practice meditation as an unsupported thought. And it's just what? Just practice meditation. Has nothing to do with sitting or lying down, says Dogen. It is just in this moment making this effort to be present, to notice the insanity. Well, the insanity comes with the latching onto the stuff, but just notice the stuff that's appearing in the mind. Don't have to get rid of it or think it's bad or chase it out or whatever. But see it for what it is. This is awakening. I've spoken of it this way. Enlightenment is nothing more than really seeing delusion. Seeing its nature. It isn't some particular thing, delusion. It has a certain nature to it. What can I say? Everything I say is wrong now. But we can see this. We can realize. And you can tell when your mind is caught up in this. I talked about that in Buddhism Plain and Simple. I talk about a leaning mind. You can detect that when your mind is being pulled this way or that. By one thing or if you slow down enough. We're so busy now we don't even realize how we're lunging this way and that. Lunging. Let alone just gently, quietly, slowly leaning. But to the extent that your mind leans, what's pulling that is that there's some belief that there really is something here that I want to get over to or get hold of or push away. So it's a matter of really waking up to that and realizing a profound subtlety and quietness of it. This is an unsupported thought. I remember once, some years ago now, they had the Sodoshu in Japan, the head of the headquarters of the Sodo School and world headquarters. And they held this big conference of second generation teachers of people. They started to realize people outside of Japan were getting transmission and stuff like this. And we were called second generation teachers. And a number of us were invited to Tassajara, and I didn't really choose to go, but I was kind of sent along with a Dharma sister of mine, and we went to this conference. And I don't remember exactly when it was, except that it was right at the same time that Clarence Thomas was being checked over for the Supreme Court. So whenever that was, I think it was 91, fall of 91. But we were spared the grueling details of, I heard it was a pretty rough confirmation hearing there for Justice Thomas. But anyway, we missed all of that. We heard about it. We knew it was happening or something, but didn't get the gory details. Anyway, at this conference, and well, there's a lot I could say. Let's see if I can abbreviate this, but people were coming around to kind of a consensus that, well, we should meet again and discuss some more of these things that were coming up. And there's a lot there, but I'll skip over, get to the point I want to make here. So a lot of things were coming up, but it's like we were having a difficult time as to maybe coming to, well, what is it that we should meet for, you know, and what are we going to put on the agenda and that sort of thing. And then I brought up that I thought, well, maybe we should just meet. No agenda. Well, that didn't go over very well at all. I can't see any reason why we would meet if we don't have any, you know, agenda. So bring in some kind of supported thought here, some supported thinking. We'll have a camp here that wants to go in this direction. Another one wants to go here, and then we'll hammer it out. And it seems like maybe we'll make some progress with this, or we end up splintering, or any number of things can happen there. Instead of just gathering together without trying to drag something here that maybe we should go in this way or in that way or whatever. But it seemed like, and this was even among a new generation of Dharma-transmitted teachers here in America. But this unsupported thought gets overlooked, the power of it, and to live out of that, to live directly out of that, to practice this meditation with no reason, with no identity, with no label, chikantaza or vipassana or whatever way you want to characterize it, just a visualization or trance or whatever, just to take this up and practice this, which is what? To just sit down. As my teacher used to say, you know, just pat your head. It's not a matter of stop thinking. Sometimes people say, then we stop thinking. Well, no, you're doing something. You're stopping thinking. You're putting the brakes on it. And you can really do that? Thinking does stop, yes. Yeah, we can experience that. But you're going to do that? No, you can't do that. Just sit down with an unsupported thought and practice this. When something is taking place in front of you, in the world around you, just be there, be present. I'm not talking about abandoning thought or actions. Thoughts and actions will come up. They have to, they do. But you don't need to steer them or orchestrate them. For example, another way of looking at this too would be like, of course this isn't going to happen, I don't suppose. But like the way we elect our leaders in this country, well, in many places, it'll be the people who got the drive, and they're going to really, you know, work at, getting their campaign going. And often, maybe they even resort to unethical things, and in the process of stepping over and getting to. Do we really want a system that encourages people to behave like that, in order to get into a position where they can govern all of us, govern the country, or the world, for that matter, in different countries? How would we arrive at leaders then? Well, maybe, I don't expect this would happen, but well, we could contemplate the possibility that, well, maybe we can just find somebody that people want to put in that position, where they themselves don't do anything. They don't say, I want this, or I'll bring this program forward, or I'll do this. I'd rather have somebody say, no, I'd rather not. But they'll take it on. If it lands on them, they'll take it up. They'll do it. I don't know if I should say this or not, but like, I didn't particularly want to start a Zen center. Wasn't really, you know, but it sort of kind of landed on me, and you just kind of step up to the plate, I guess. But that'd be a radically different way, and the kind of values and the ways that a society would function would change radically over time. And the ambitious ones, yeah, well, they can still find their niches and things. But maybe they shouldn't be put right up there at the head of everything. You know, I have that gentleman over there in Russia. I don't want to criticize him so much, but if we look at this, from what I gather, there's a lot of personal ambition there that he wants. He wants the old Soviet Union back, basically. But his people apparently don't. They don't want that. Majority of the Russians are very upset with this war that he started. And all the lying and stuff that went into setting up so they would have their excuses for why they needed to invade Ukraine. Well, fortunately, very few people are buying that around the world. But we look at this. Look at these kinds of situations. Look who ends up being our leaders. For the moment, we know we've had some wonderful leaders along the way, too. I don't mean the... But it's the way that we go about allowing people to get into those kinds of positions where they'll seek more power and to eliminate any kind of checks and balances that would be working, you know, to stabilize them a bit. And then we'll let them get away with those. And it's rather foolish in a way. But this unsupported thought that we are here in the world, we do meet, we come together, but maybe through the kind of workings of the natural way that things will work, to the extent that we can try to stop controlling it all, make it go this way. This is my idea. I want to. Yeah, well, if we can probably even express the idea. That was James Madison's, was our fourth president, I think, in his idea that the various factions can kind of balance it. Yeah, there's something to that. But anyway, well, at this point, I'm just starting to ramble on. I was going to say, too, I made a little note here about that time I was out there at Tassajara. And that was the last time I flew in an airplane because I didn't know it. I didn't know what it was called. But I suffered from Fliegskam. Fliegskam. Flight shame. Oh. It's a Swedish word. They've just coined it recently. Fliegskam. And I've got it. I was... I did some... A lot of traveling in the 80s and flying about a bit. And I was starting to get... Knowing what I knew then about global warming and all of this and where it was going, I just couldn't do it in good conscience anymore. And then when I... And I wasn't planning to go out to Tassajara, as I mentioned, but I was kind of sent, and so anyway, I flew. But that was the last time I'd flown, in 91 or whatever it was. I remember coming in there over San Francisco, bang, we were out over the Pacific there a bit, beyond the Golden Gate, and the plane was banking, and I just kind of looked out my window here, and way down there was the Golden Gate Bridge. And I just thought to myself, what am I doing up here? Anyway, but the shame really, flight shame, it really took over after that one, and I haven't, so far it's kept me from doing any more flying since, you know. So it's been, over 30 years now, I guess. And I realized, you don't have to fly. If there was some reason where I had to fly, I'd fly, but I just can't imagine what it would take. But though at times I feel like, okay, all right. Especially after this last bit of information I got. What's the point? Because my little flying here isn't going to make any difference. But what I want to do is to, first of all, live out of awareness. Whatever that awareness dictates for me, then I'll do it, even if it's something I don't want to do. I'd like to fly. I'd like to skitter around very quickly from here to there. That'd be nice. But doing it in the context. No, I'm not. This is my own shame. I'm not shaming any others, any of you, and I don't judge you. If you fly, you might not know what I know, and any number of reasons could be there. You might have some real emergency you have to go. Yeah, I understand. So and that's another thing that's very important, what I was trying to say here too. You don't know the minds of others. Don't judge them. Don't put anything on them. It's not your business, really. Your business is watch your own mind. So here, and now that I have a word for it, fleekscom, thanks to the Swedes. I don't know if that Greta Thunberg, if she was the one that maybe brought this to people's attention or something. Anyway, but that was just a sidebar thought. I probably should end it there. And it's almost got a minute left if anybody has a question. Yeah, David.
Does pious practices extend to limiting oneself to eloquent speech?
Does it extend to limiting one's... I didn't quite...
Limiting oneself to eloquent speech.
No, a pious practice is going on in your mind. Watch your mind. What actually comes out, whether it's eloquent or garbled or anything else. And that's, again, why not to judge. But just watch your mind. Your mind. Not somebody else, because you can't watch it. You don't know what they're thinking. You might think, well, I know what you're thinking. Yeah, well, maybe. One guy thought he knew so well what I was thinking, he put it into a book, for crying out loud. We're still friends. So we can be absolutely sure about something or other. Like I said, when I read that, I was really kind of surprised, because I realized that was me describing. And when I brought it up to him later, he said, yeah, and I told him, actually, you know, at that time, what was happening, my mind was running almost in the opposite direction of what you know. But you can't know things like that. And it's helpful to keep that in mind. Maybe sometimes you have to kind of get a sense of where somebody's coming from. Okay, that's fine, but don't clamp down on it like you know. You could be very wrong. But it's always a matter of watch your own mind. So we have this term, then, pious speech. Well, what exactly is that? And does it mean this and that? You know, well, he's just pointing to something there. But often it's where we think, this is the right way. This is what's good and should be done. And we're carrying this out. And all those kinds of things. Just watch the mind that practices. You know, whatever it might be. And again, don't judge your own mind. But just see it. If you judge it, you're not seeing it. You're judging. No. And you got ideas linked to that. Just see this. It's quite subtle. It's profound. But it's absolutely imperative in terms of, do you want to live out of awakeness or not? I hope that answered you there, David. No? Okay. All right. We better end it, though. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening. To hear more talks on Buddhism, Zen, and related topics, visit dharmafield.org.